Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
I'm Pools.
And today we'll be starting our reread of The Running Grave, covering the prologue and chapters 1 through 4 of part 1. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Running Grave will occasionally, and by occasionally, I mean always, reference the ending of this book, as well as the previous books in the series.
Literally always.
Yeah, I realize as I was saying that occasionally is just no, that's not accurate.
This ending.
No.
Yeah, people should make it a drinking game every time we mention the ending.
Oh, God. Alcohol poisoning.
Oh, they'd be trash. Man.
Don't want to be responsible for anybody's hospital bill.
It's not our fault.
It's not. With an ending that good, I make no apologies.
But yeah, I do think that we should probably take a second just to give an extra spoiler warning in case there are any new listeners, because we talk all kinds of spoilers when we do these episodes, because one of the best parts of a reread is finding all the clues that we missed, which in my case is 100% of them. So
oh, yeah.
Same.
So just please make sure that you finished The Running Grave before you listen to this and all the other books, I guess, if you haven't. And also, thank you for all of the emails and DMs about our review episode. It was nice to see that our totally unhinged emotion was exactly what a lot of you needed. That was really nice.
Yeah. We're hashtag relatable.
Yeah, it really makes up for the less than nice comments that we've seen where people just complain about us being too thirsty or obsessed with the romance stuff.
Guilty as charged.
I mean, if that's how you feel, I have some bad news for you, my boys.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not changing. So
yeah.
This is going to be a bad season for the people who hate the strike thirst.
It's not going to be good.
Sorry in advance. I'm not sorry.
I'm not sorry. No. I'm not sorry at all.
I have no remorse.
You're welcome, is what I say to our listeners. You are welcome.
Anyway, also thank you to everyone for hearing our request for no spoilers in the comments, because I don't think I saw a single one.
Mm-hmm.
And we appreciate that.
Yeah. So we have actually got a teeny bit of news. So we got confirmation that Joe is working on Strike 8. And I have to say that if we get an announcement of 8's title in mid-January, like we did this year, I am going to lose my mind.
It'd be so amazing.
And for any listeners that are wondering what we'll do if we end up finishing Running Grave before 8's released and we actually have any kind of time, we'll probably be doing Silkworm next.
I love Silkworm. I know a lot
Me
of
too.
People, it's their least favorite. I love it.
I like it too.
It's got a hand kiss. How can you not? That's the height
it
of romance.
It does have a hand kiss.
I can't believe that we got a hand kiss in book 2 and now we're on book fucking 7 and they still haven't real kissed. Like, he kisses my hand. I'm jumping him on the way out the door. Ridiculous. Okay, sorry.
I feel like you need to take something up with Joe. You seem upset about this.
I'm upset.
A strongly worded letter.
I like it. I'm here for it. Mm-hmm. I'm loving the plan.
Me too. Yep, I do. I complain, but I love the ride.
Especially after when she said last year after Ink Black Heart to trust her plan. Yes, I believed her. But then when you read The Running Grave, like the mm-hmm. most beautiful.
It's
we
so
wouldn't
beautiful.
Have any of it if it, you know what I mean? It's just.
It's true. It's true. It's worth the buildup. It's worth the wait.
It's worth everything. Anyway, we posted our schedule for this, for The Running Grave. A couple weeks ago. And there were a couple of people who took a look at that and understood exactly what we were planning for and made comments that we were planning for a book 8 release next year. And I mean, yeah, we have to, because we were completely caught off guard with The Running Grave being out in 1 year. So yeah, as much as I like Silkworm, my money is on book 8 being released next fall. And we had to plan it this way just in case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know what else I'm really excited for, though, is the first time she changes her header.
We're
gonna
know.
Yes, that's my favorite thing.
I know, me too.
I love the clues.
Same. I'm already dying over it, and she hasn't even posted it yet.
It's exciting.
Another thing that I'm really, really excited for are the Q&As for this book. Now, as of this recording, we actually just had an announcement not too long ago that there's going to be a Q&A coming out on October 19th. And I'm so curious what she has to say about this book. And I can't wait to talk about these questions and answers with all of you, because whatever it is, it's going to be really good.
Yeah. So by the time people are listening to this, we'll have already all heard them, but we can start going over them in our next one.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be exciting. Okay, before we dive into the chapters, I've been thinking about a couple things that I wish I had remembered to talk about in our review episode. But again, chaotic, unhinged, not planned episode. I forget things. But there are a couple of things that I think I was really wrong about. And so I just wanted to make sure that I bring them up and acknowledge how wrong I think I was.
That's so weird, because when I'm wrong about something, I just memory hole it. I pretend it never happened. But you want to bring this forward and put it out there. Okay.
I'm just trying to be, you know,
straightforward,
honest about what I'm wrong about. Yes. I feel like if I want to take my thoughts seriously, then I need to look at what I was right about and what I was wrong about, and then kind of try to adjust those things as I go forward. That's the only way I know how to do it.
Mm-hmm. You have a reputation for honesty and integrity.
I've heard that somewhere.
I know. It's so weird.
Anyway, okay. So the first thing I got wrong was that Strike did not go to therapy like I thought he would. This was a theory I had because of J.K. Rowling saying on Twitter last year that someone suggests therapy to him in The Running Grave. Mm-hmm. I'm not really upset about being wrong about this or that he didn't go, because I think what we did get had the same healing results that I was after with that. And that's really the important bit.
For sure. I feel the exact same way, because he did some pretty major healing in this book. And the chapter where it happens in a big way for him is easily one of the most powerful and emotional chapters in the book. And I would go so far as to say the whole series. So I'm not mad about it.
Mm-hmm. You're thinking of chapter 64, right?
Yes.
Yeah. It was the most beautiful thing she's ever written, I think.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm. I think the only chapter of hers that I've ever read that has been as beautiful as that is the one in Deathly Hallows, whenever Harry's walking to Voldemort.
The forest again?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good one.
I used to be able to like recite part of the first couple of pages because I had read it so many times.
The other thing I think I was wrong about is Robin's cover being blown. And I say I think I was wrong because maybe it's debatable. She was definitely compromised by the time she escaped. But I'm still counting it as being wrong because it wasn't the way I was expecting, which was that someone inside would know exactly who she was and either threaten to tell or actually tell. So I don't know.
It is debatable. You could count yourself at least half right. She was compromised while she was under. It was by her own slip up with the Robin thing. And it was that slip up that led to the UHC being able to figure out who she was after the fact. Mm. So her real identity did come out. I think you should get a half win.
Okay, I'll take it.
Bronze medal.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Maybe I should add to the list also that I thought I would like Ryan Murphy more than I do.
Yeah.
Definitely a wrong one
we
there.
Did not turn out to like him very much at all.
No, we, the ones who were trying to defend him.
I was on board. Now I'm all for it.
Yeah, I take it back.
Neo-Nazi.
I take
it back. He's a cooking cop. Yeah. Same.
All right. Let's get into book talk.
Yes. Let's get into the actual book. The Strike and Ellicott series, book 7. Crack open the spine. Here we go.
I'm ready.
So this book starts out with two epigraphs. So the first one is from Dylan Thomas's When Like a Running Grave. And that is When Like a Running Grave, Time Tracks You Down. And then the other one is from The I Ching or Book of Changes. And it's specifically from the Wilhelm translation. And it is, it took a long time for things to go so far. It came about because things that should have been stopped were not stopped soon enough.
I feel like the Dylan Thomas one really applies more to the case. I kind of like it as a sort of warning to the killer in this book, because time and Strike and Robin are about to track her down. She got away with murder 21 years ago and her time is up. Mm-hmm. And I guess you could say the same thing about the Waces and all of the UHC as well.
Yeah, you absolutely could. When we first learned, first of all, the title of the book and then that Dylan Thomas was in fact the epigraph, I thought that his poetry was going to feature so much more heavily in this book's epigraphs. And I was playing with all these kind of different ideas about the book based on his themes. But turns out, no, it's only just this one little bit. So I think you're probably right in that it's referring to time catching up on these wrongdoers.
Aren't we all kind of glad that it wasn't Dylan Thomas, though?
Yeah, the I Ching is so much easier.
So much more straightforward.
It's easier and so much fun.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, in the interest of thoroughness, looking at this actual poem, I had an idea that it might also speak a bit to one of Jonathan Wace's obsessions. He's obsessed with bloodlines, and it is his daughter who's the killer. In my interpretation, the poem is about sort of the inevitability of death and the desperate search for immortality through sex and reproduction as a way to live on from beyond the grave, which to me seems to fit with Wace, right? Because he's in this desperate attempt to keep all his bloodline together, right? But in the end, it's his bloodline that brings death and murder and destruction, which is suiting. There's just something poetic about his bloodline being the thing that brings it all crashing down on him in the end.
It's poetic justice, right?
It is poetic justice.
Yeah.
Because it's a poem.
Okay.
But
very funny.
So the I Ching one works for me on both levels, though, the case and the personal. It works for the case because the disappearance / death of Dayu is a 21-year-old cold case that should have been resolved right away. Too many people knew about that for it to have gone on as long as it did.
I feel like this one also kind of speaks to the larger problem of the cult as a whole. So both Dayu as the prophet and the UHC. The UHC should have been stopped a long time ago, should have been stopped when they raided the Crothers at the farm, should have been stopped before that. But it was allowed to carry on and mutate and spread its evil. It makes me think of the comparisons of the UHC in this book to a cancer. And to Robin's pessimism at the end of the novel, because at the close of this book, we, the reader, are like, oh, they've succeeded. They've brought down this cult. It's all over. But have they? Robin thinks it's only a matter of time before another five-sided temple appears, which brings me back to this epigraph and the thought that perhaps the reason it was not stopped when it should have been was because it literally cannot be stopped. And every attempt will only pause it before it mutates and grows again.
That's kind of depressing.
Yeah, sorry. That's a depressing way to open the season, isn't it?
It's depressing, but also it's realistic because think of how many cults are in existence right now that have been exposed but continue to go. Because when I watched the ending of the Keep Sweet documentary, I was ready to celebrate when Warren Jeffs was arrested and convicted and was in prison. But then it was like, oh, wait, he still controls everything and does sermons by phone.
Yeah.
But I think it also works for the personal side of things because of all the healing that Strike and Lucy do in this book in regards to Leda and other things. But of all the things that happened to them in their childhood, we see that they've had major consequences, negative consequences on their adult lives. But in this case, I think there is a happy ending for both of them. It's not as dreary as it is when you apply it to the case or as the passage suggests.
Yeah, I feel like you said it best, Linz. This really is the book of changes for the book of changes, isn't it?
It really is, which I love. I have so many emotions about the changes and healing that Strike goes through in this book. And I really love this stuff with Lucy and Leda.
Oh, yeah. Me too. The Strike family stuff in this book is so good.
So this particular line of the I Ching comes from book 3 of the commentaries. And as you said, Kenz, this is the Wilhelm translation. And if anyone's curious, that's the translation that all of these epigraphs come from. Anyway, this line is from Hexagram 2, the Receptive, which is interesting to me that this was the hexagram that frames the entire novel because it is made up entirely of broken lines or yin lines, meaning it is the essential feminine hexagram. It's the female property, the receptive. Do you remember when Tayo tells Robin that she's a receptive? He states that the receptive is female, the creative male. This is the hexagram that he's referring to. But what's funny to me is that Robin hardly embodies the principle of the receptive in this book because she's the one who's the active force of this investigation out in the world for most of the novel. And I would say that Corman actually embodies the receptive much more than Robin does. And that's why his growth is so beautiful, because he is the yielding yet firm essence of Hexagram 2. He's a solid foundation for Robin, but he himself has opened up his mind to change and renewal and rebirth. And I know that this is going off into a rabbit hole and all kind of nonsense, but I just feel like Joe is playing with the I Ching's traditional sort of patriarchal interpretations of the male-female, both here and throughout the book. I think it's really neat.
It is neat. No, I don't think it's nonsense. I like that a lot. And it's like when Tayo says it, because he wants to control her.
Mm-hmm.
But when Strike is doing it, it's a personal choice to open up to change, right?
And Tayo is using it to make her subordinate.
Right.
But with Strike, the receptive and the creative are properly two halves of a whole that work together. And neither can exist without the other, right? And they're very fluid. It shifts between Robin and Cormoran. So I just love them so much.
Really?
Yeah, I know no one knew that, but I really love them.
If we're making confessions, I love them too.
Same.
All right, should we go to the prologue?
Yeah.
We should. So in the prologue, we have ourselves a bit of an epistolary section. So lots of letters that give us background on the case and the UHC. So the epigraph, all individuals are not equally fitted to consult the oracle. requires a clear and tranquil mind receptive to the cosmic influences hidden in the humble divining stocks. And that is Richard Wilhelm from The I Ching or Book of Changes. And that's where all of the epigraphs are coming from. So we don't need to mention it again. We'll just be mentioning what hexagrams they come from.
What I think this is talking about is Will's receptiveness to the UHC and how he got sucked in. Mm-hmm. In all these letters and emails, we're told by Will's father that Will is autistic and how he believes that played a role in his particular situation and susceptibility. Now, obviously, that's not the only reason. And as we see, anyone can be susceptible to this, but it is laid out for us as an important part of Will's character. While it seems to have had a hand in why he went along with it at first, I also think it's a big part of what saved him from being fully indoctrinated.
Mm. Yeah, I think that you are bang on the money.
I definitely think you're right about Will being receptive to the cosmic influences of the UHC. In this passage of the introduction, being fit to consult the Oracle it's a powerful good. But as we see for Will, this receptiveness is incredibly destructive when it's twisted to evil purposes. And there is evil hidden in what appears to be the humble divining stocks of the UHC's spiritual practice. It's part of one of the larger patterns of the novel, where the principles of the UHC appropriate traditions like the I Ching and misuse them to their own selfish, greedy, sadistic ends without actually connecting with what they're supposed to be about in the first place. It's twisted. The receptiveness is no longer a good, powerful thing. It's a danger.
So the first letters that we read are between Will and his parents, Colin and Sally Ensor, who are obviously shocked and upset. And then we get to see the very odd responses that Will gives, which was fun. It's interesting to read it now, knowing how the UHC handles letters and how they tell them what to write, because you can see that happening in these letters where his parents say it doesn't sound like him and all of the weird lingo.
Yes, all of the cult speak. I assume that a lot of the letters that Will writes are literally from the templates that they make Robin write from later, right?
Oh yeah, totally.
Yeah, with the relevant bits about his own situation, like his autism added in. And note the use of his parents' first names. We now know exactly why the church forces people to do this, to destroy their connections with their family, to isolate them, to keep their only loyalty to the principles of the church. So you can see the cult tactics in these letters, and it's so cool.
The first time I read it, I remember thinking, flesh object, ego motivity. Now they all feel so familiar.
I know they do. Flesh object still seems so creepy.
It is. Word flesh is a weird word.
It is.
I know. They seem so alien and weird to me, but now I'm tweeting with them. Now I'm calling my husband my flesh object. I'm like, oh, my flesh object's off getting me Starbucks, you know?
It's the new bois and muck fluff.
Yeah, the new bois.
How did you all feel the first time you read The Drowned Prophet Will Bless All Who Worship Her? Because I was a bit creeped out, but also really excited because I knew it was going to be good.
Oh yeah, I definitely had like the exact same reaction, just simultaneously like super creeped out but knowing, oh man, this is gonna be good.
It's interesting, the phrase, looking back, because the Drowned Prophet is so much more a figure of terror and punishment in the church. She doesn't appear to actually be associated with any blessings other than these rote phrases, does she?
No, of course not.
She's the monster under the bed. She's not Santa Claus in this church.
Another thing I immediately noticed was the different approaches to Will by Colin and Sally. And I find this interesting because at first I was thinking that Sally's approach was 100% the way to go, just keep showing him love. But now that we've read the book, I think it's more likely that the angry letters would be shown to someone as opposed to the loving ones.
And you know what's so awful is, like, after reading this book, you know that the people in the UHC are conditioning these people. So regardless of how they respond, they have some sort of bullshit reason why you shouldn't be taking this person seriously or listening to what they have to say. You know, they're going to say that it shows, you know, high levels of ego motivity or materialistic possession of, you know, by your flesh objects and, you know, all this other kind of crap. And it's just so frustrating and also so creepy and awful.
It is.
I really don't like the word flesh.
It's a terror. It's like right up there with moist, you know?
I've never minded moist, but flesh is just creeping me out. Ugh. Moist flesh.
The moist flesh.
No.
That's horrifying.
I just got like a full body shiver. Oh, God.
So I read the book that Prudence gives Strike in one of these early chapters, Stephen Hassan's Combating Cult Mind Control, before this book came out, as sort of preparation for understanding cult stuff. And, you know, Sally's approach is much more in line with what he recommends in dealing with family members who are in cults. At least it's much better than Sir Colin's, because anger or attacking the church is 100% guaranteed to basically prove the church right. Mm-hmm. And the cult member becoming defensive will make them double down on their commitment, right? So the right thing to do is to keep the door open between you, to remind them of their life outside, to show a willingness to listen to what they have to say. It's not guaranteed to help, but it's more likely than that sort of anger response.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, but I don't mean if or when they had the ability to actually speak to him. I just mean that I bet Mazu would be more likely to pass on those angry letters than she would pass on the loving one.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, that makes super sense, because she would be more likely to give the angry letters to Will, because those are the ones that serve her purpose.
I totally understand him losing his cool. How do you not?
Oh, totally. It can be so difficult when someone that you love or care for is doing something that you just know is either unsafe or it's bad for them, and they're just not listening. So frustrating, but super understandable.
Yeah. I mean, even having said what I said, I identify way more with Sir Colin, because I too would be furious. I don't know if I'd have the self-control to deal with a family member in the correct way, because I'd be too pissed off.
I like to think that I could have handled it like Sally, but I don't know if I could have.
Oh, yeah. I don't know that I could have either.
We would all hope that, you know, we could be as compassionate and understanding as Sally is being here. But that being said, I just want to say that I really like these small moments, especially in this book, where you're kind of forced to consider how you yourself might have reacted in that same situation.
Yeah, she does that to us a lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The only other thing I have about this first set of letters is that Colin's threat to have the police involved did seem to really work. Mm-hmm. Knowing what we know now, I bet nothing short of that would have resulted in someone at Chapman Farm actually getting to visit a family member. I'm sorry, a flesh object.
So throughout this chapter, we get a bunch of dates to these letters. And just mm-hmm. like in Ink Black Heart, I love looking at these dates and figuring out what Strike and Robin were up to when this was going down. It's so much fun for me. Because again, that sense of world building, right? The sense of an ongoing universe. So Will first enters the cult and exchanges these letters with his parents in the few months right before Lethal White, when Strike and Robin were still in their miserable year of estrangement.
Well, after the prologue?
Yeah, after the prologue.
Okay, because for a second I thought you meant during...
No, I mean like a few months before the main action of Lethal White. And around this time, Patterson is hired to try and get Will out. So while Corman and Robin are off being miserable, detecting without talking to each other, Patterson is screwing up this investigation. I wonder how different things would have been had Sir Colin gone to Strike and Robin instead the first time.
I knew you were going to do this and I was excited about it, because I love thinking about what they were up to too. But I don't think that Robin would have been able to do what she did in this book back in 2012. Not only because of the experience, but her panic attacks.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. And never mind the fit that Matthew would have thrown about her going undercover for 4 months. Can you imagine?
Oh my God.
She needed these years of growth as a person and as a professional to be able to tackle this case. So I guess thanks to Patterson for screwing this up and drawing this whole thing out, I guess.
So the next bit of correspondence is the UHC lawyers talking to Kevin about his blog. Mm-hmm. And as a side note, I just feel so bad for Kevin rereading this. There's that bit later on when Robin acknowledges how much bravery it must have taken him to not only escape, but to figure out how to live on the outside.
Yeah.
It just made me sad that he couldn't have been helped before Abigail got to him.
I'm so heartbroken thinking about what people like Kevin and Emily could have been had they never been dragged into this cult as babies. Because like you say, Kevin especially must have had so much natural intelligence and bravery. What could he have done with his life if his education hadn't been useless, if he hadn't been so damaged by trauma? And then there's Emily, who clearly has enormous strength of will to still be resisting the cult's brainwashing after so many years and so much punishment.
They still have time.
Emily still has time, thank God. Yes.
Yes, Emily. But you just made me think about Kevin's writing. He wrote well in his letters. He sounded like a smart guy. It's weird when you contrast that with Abigail making a point to talk about her lack of education and not understanding words. I don't know where I'm going with this, but I feel like there's something in that that I'm not seeing yet.
Yeah.
It's something about Abigail that's interesting at the moment.
Because Kevin does seem remarkably literate for the level of education he received in the church.
Yeah.
Because we know it's not great. He mentions that Louise used to teach her kids stuff like multiplication tables when they were on the farm. Maybe that helped. I was wondering, as I was reading this book, whether he'd been out for a while when he started his blog, like a couple of years, if he'd spent the time reading, teaching himself. But looking at the timeline, so Kevin was 6 when Dayu died in 1995. He says that he started planning to escape the cult when he was almost 23, and it took him over a year to get out. So he would have been just about to turn 24, just have turned 24, which would set him escaping in late 2012, early 2013.
Uh-oh, pretend I didn't say anything. Yeah. Back it up.
Because it doesn't make sense, because we know he was writing his blog in April 2012. So now I'm confused and the timeline doesn't
make sense. Maybe he was just
sense.
Confused. It's fine. He just, you know.
Yeah, maybe he just got his age wrong.
He doesn't know his age.
Few years. He did look up his birth records when he got out. Though.
Okay.
I can't reconcile it. Fine. Someone help me, please.
Maybe
I know
it's just
we're
a mistake.
Not supposed to look at the timeline. Let's ignore the timeline.
I wouldn't have noticed it ever. Anyway, let's go over Kevin's blog posts. So the first one was a big deal for us because we immediately got a huge bit of information connected to Strike that the UHC was born out of the Aylmerton community, a notorious Norfolk-based commune. Yeah.
Right.
Just there's no denying it now that this is going to be a direct connection to the worst time of Strike's childhood, and hearing about the arrests for pedophilia only confirmed my fears for Lucy.
Oh, yeah.
Were we convinced that there would be a connection between the two before the sample released? I feel like we were kind of taking it for granted there would be.
Yeah.
But even with that, I was still like, gasp, scream face emoji. I've stopped being able to use words completely. It was an expected shock.
That happened to me later in the book as well. So an expected shock, yeah.
Someone let me know if other languages have a word for a shock that you were expecting.
I bet it's probably like in German or something.
I was going to say German probably has something, or Japanese, or let us know.
Yeah, reading this was like, holy shit, this place has a name now. It's not just some mysterious commune. It's a place with a name. And yeah, same here as far as having fears for what Lucy had been through. As soon as that mention of pedophilia came up, it was like, oh no.
Yeah. Another expected shock, because I completely expected it.
Mm-hmm. Completely.
Yeah. Let's go through and list all of the allegations that Kevin is putting out there in his blog. So like we just discussed, he tipped us off to the Aylmerton connection and that there's pedophilia going on. The sexual abuse isn't quite the same as Aylmerton, although I know that's splitting hairs, but I knew that we were in for some terrible sexual abuse going on, and I was worried about Robin after reading the sample.
As if we weren't already super worried about her going undercover, I was like, okay, so now we need to be triple worried about her? Mm-hmm. That's great.
And we had to sit on that for weeks.
Oh my God, that was agony.
I know.
Oh.
I know. I will say that I was positive that she wouldn't actually be raped.
Yeah.
I really did not believe that that would happen, but it doesn't mean that it wasn't scary.
It's still terrifying. And I was not positive she wouldn't get her hair shaved off.
Nope.
Mm-mm. I was not positive about that. I was like, that was a real possibility
either.
For me. And I was so scared. Oh my God.
Same.
Because yeah, you're right. I'm like, Joe's not going to have her be raped again. That's not going
right,
to happen.
Exactly.
But the hair?
Yeah.
That would have like broken her.
Yeah, I was absolutely terrified of that. I was so afraid of it because it would be just such an awful violation.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Okay.
I was
safe.
So scared.
Her hair's safe.
I know.
Her body's
know.
Safe. She's okay, guys. The fictional character is okay.
Okay, so the UHC, their claim that there is no longer sexual abuse happening was believed by literally no one reading this book, right?
Right. The bullshit level of that statement was off the scale.
Another one of his accusations is that the sole purpose of the UHC is generating money.
It's interesting to me that Kevin phrases it this way, that it's the sole purpose of the UHC, because for me, while reading, it was clear that one of the primary goals of the cult, along with this money, was to provide a pool of women and girls for the male principals to abuse at their will. I mean, Harmon is basically using the farm as his very own underage brothel. And it's clear that Wace values his own sexual gratification and desire for power just as much as the money. It's all tied together, and Mazu as well. So I wondered if Kevin, being male and living less under the ever-present threat of rape, not that he wasn't still vulnerable and coerced and damaged, because of course he was, but I wonder if he saw this motivation motivation less clearly than a woman or a girl in the cult would. Like if he was focused on the money, whereas the girls would understand more the other primary motive, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think that you might be right.
I get what you're saying. I'm trying to think if we can contrast that with a woman's perspective. Mm-hmm. Flora was aware of the trafficking. Yeah. Maybe Kevin also had this really clear picture of everything just because of how long he was in.
Mm-hmm. It's just that the money is not the sole purpose. And it was weird to me that he phrased it that way.
He also accuses them of using and exploiting the death of Dai Weiss. And obviously the UHC denies this. What's interesting is that he accuses Mazu of this, and she's the one who actually doesn't know what happened to her. Jonathan Weiss is the one who's really guilty of that. But it makes me think of that bit later where Robin tells Strike that she does kind of use it.
And Mazu totally does.
Yeah.
I wonder whether her use of that was entirely about the power and control it gave her, or whether for some tiny part of Mazu that was a mother, it was a way of dealing with grief, believing that her daughter's death had some kind of purpose for the cult. Helped her, maybe?
I could see that.
I mean, I could see why that would help anyone.
Yeah.
But it is hard for me to find the sympathy for Mazu. It might be a little too fresh right now, coming out of this book.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Very little. Whether she was born a monster or the abuse made her into a monster, she still turned into a full-on monster.
This is a Janice thing all over again.
Yeah, this is a Janice. This is a Creed. This is all of them. Really.
The next bit of correspondence are just emails between Sir Colin and Kevin. These are really quick. Two emails where Kevin asks for financial help because the UHC is taking him to court. Mm. It made me sad because Kevin's so optimistic and was so determined to fight and do the right thing.
Yeah. His tone in these emails compared to later is...
Yeah, it was hopeful.
Yeah.
It also made me like Sir Colin because he was immediately ready to pay.
Sir Colin's a bois, for sure.
He is a bois.
He definitely is a bois.
Okay, let's get to this next bit. It's a short interview with UHC member and actress Nolie Seymour. I really don't like her. What did you guys think of her?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, this was where I started to get a serious Scientology vibe from the church.
Same.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The celebrities shilling for it, making it look glamorous and brilliant. Well, we know full well that they're getting all the benefits and none of the starvation or torture or abuse of the true cult experience. Yeah. I wanted to smack this twit in the face.
Yes,
she's an idiot.
Me too.
Yeah.
I got big Tom Cruise vibes from her.
Like she's 2 minutes away from jumping up and down on the chair or whatever. Uh-huh.
Maybe that's why I didn't like her so much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just felt so angry that you can be a person with such power and privilege and look the other way when you see people underfed, when you see women and girls with their heads shaved as punishment, when you know what happens in the retreat rooms, everything. How can you be someone who can freely walk away and just ignore it and say it's great?
Right.
With Harmon, the author, I get why he's in it, right? Because he's getting away with rape. But what is her deal? Getting to look like a good person? I don't get her. She makes me very angry.
She's just peak self-absorbed, selfish narcissist who doesn't care about other people at all.
Not a fan.
No. Same.
Anyway, is there anything about her interview that stands out?
Yeah, it is so weird to me that Nolie chose the Golden Prophet to memorialize with a tattoo, because for the regular members, the Drowned Prophet is so much more central to the belief system, right? But
yeah,
I suppose it shows a couple of things. It shows how little she's actually been hardcore indoctrinated into the daily cult life. And it also is a bit of a nod as to her role in the church. She's funneling them the money. Maybe she fancies herself as a second Golden Prophet.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Oh, also, you'd think that tattoos weren't allowed, or at least new ones once you're in, because of the whole, you know, no individuality thing.
Right. I bet Nolie's allowed to dye her hair.
Of course. It's just another thing that shows her special treatment.
Mm-hmm.
That is my general feeling about her, is just, ugh.
Yeah. Ugh.
Next, there are emails between Sir Colin and his lawyer.
I want to note here that these emails take place 3 days after Whiskey Night in Troubled Blood.
Aw.
Oh, ho.
I don't have any other response than, aw. Yeah.
Just remembering Whiskey Night.
Remembering Whiskey Night, yeah.
Remembering Let's take a second. When the first time he felt like a trapeze artist stepping out into the black.
And now remembering the second time.
Now we're remembering the second time.
And how they were both interrupted. Okay,
10th
anyway.
Time this episode? Okay.
Take your shot now if you're playing the drinking game.
Yeah. With these letters, I was thinking, you know, some people would criticize Sir Colin, and later in the book, he is criticized for being so concerned about Will's trust fund. Like, he only cares about the money. But I mean, would you want a penny of your family's money going to fund this horrific cult? Like, are you going to pay for new pillows for the rape rooms? No, I don't want my money going to that. I would fight tooth and nail to stop it too, just on principle. Plus, there's the fact that if Will ever gets out, he'd need that money to live. I don't blame Sir Colin at all for being concerned about the trust fund.
No, I don't either. It's completely understandable. And I would think a solid argument in court to show that someone isn't making sane decisions.
Yeah.
100%. So yeah, I'd bring that up too.
I'm so frustrated for Sir Colin in this whole section.
I know. We have another celebrity interview with author and rapist Giles Harmon. Reading this makes me want to punch this man straight in the throat because I hate him. Denying that the UHC is doing anything wrong while we know he takes teenage girls to the retreat room. So
I'm right with you there. Can we use our brass knuckles for that throat punching?
Do we have like a collective pair of brass knuckles that we all share?
Bring out the knuckles, ladies.
Who do we want to punch in this book?
Right.
When Harmon says, I've stumbled upon a unique way of meeting what I feel is the universal need for the divine. Yeah, that unique way is raping teenage girls. So let's put him on the list with Tim Ashcroft, the pedophile, for the special punishment.
The amputation special.
The snip, snip one.
The snip, snip special. Yes.
Should we start referring to him as Giles Harmon, the pedophile, like we did for What's His Face and Ink Black Heart?
I think there are too many people that we'd have to use that name for in this book if we did it.
There's so many goddamn pedophiles and rapists. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, the only good part of this interview was hearing that Kevin protested one of his events. I was like, good for him.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm really starting to feel sad about Kevin's death on this reread, you know?
I feel ya.
It's so useless and so much wasted potential. It's right up there with Morehouse, you know?
Oh, God. Yeah. It is. But in other news, in timeline news, this Giles interview takes place right around when Edie Ledwell was killed. And these emails run through the beginning of Ink Black Heart. So we're catching up to the timeline.
Almost at the end here with two more emails between Sir Colin and Kevin. Sir Colin isn't as happy as I am about Kevin making a scene at Giles Harmon's event. And we hear from Kevin that he's struggling with suppressed memories and the mention of the drowned prophet coming for him.
Yeah, you can feel Kevin spiraling in this last email when you contrast his depressed nature, the book being canceled, his scattered memories of the child. You can feel him falling apart and your own dread is intensifying here. It was neat that we got a Roper Chard mention here, though.
It's neat because Liz Tassel was mentioned in this book, not by name, but there is that bit about Wace's eyes being like a shark's eyes and how Strike had seen that in A Killer before. That was a fun callback.
Yeah, that was.
And then the last bit is really sad. Three letters from Will's parents that we now know he never received. I was so sad when I read this.
Yeah, it is heartbreaking. How is Will ever going to get over the guilt of this once he's out of this cult?
It's probably helpful that they never showed him.
Yeah.
If they had and he still had to make the choice to stay, even if it was out of fear, that might have been harder to recover from. Yeah. And hopefully he takes Prudence up on her offer.
Therapy for everyone.
We say that every time.
I know. Lots of people need therapy.
Anyway, as good as this prologue is, I appreciate it so much more on a reread because when we first got this sample and I read this for the first time, it felt like the longest thing I have ever read in my entire life because I was so desperate to get to Strike and Robin. I was surprised when we reread this and did it how short it actually is because it felt real long the first time.
I feel you. I was actually amazed at our self-control for actually reading through it rather than just skipping to part one.
Yeah, I would never actually skip it. I would never do that. But
no, I wouldn't either. But still, give ourselves a round of applause for not doing that.
Okay, should we do part one?
Finally, we get Carmen and Robin. So we get an epigraph to part one. And part one is Ching, the well. The well, the town may be changed, but the well cannot be changed. And that's from Hexagram 48.
I was thinking that this one is talking about Strike because we see a lot of change in him in this first part. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of connecting the town may be changed with the parts of Strike that have changed, but also connecting the well with his heart or who he is at his core, which has not.
Yeah.
I know the book uses the Wilhelm translations, but as we've talked about before, I have a couple other decks that Jo has used when she's posted pictures of them. And I've been using those to kind of help spark ideas or understanding when I'm struggling with an epigraph. I'm going to call these the header deck and the cake deck. So mm-hmm. I know which is which because she used one in her header and then one was in her picture with her birthday cake. So that's just how I'm going to identify them. So I really like the way the cake deck described the well as the foundations of life that endure. And the header deck asked the question, what is the ever-present resource you draw from? And so for Strike, I think those things are his passion for his vocation, for truth, justice, and for Robin. So I think that this epigraph is saying to us, the readers, that there are things about Strike that are going to be different in this book, but the core of who he is, the well, is still there. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that there's other things we can apply it to as we go through, but that's just kind of the first thing that jumped out at me.
I love this interpretation. I think that you're right.
I mostly love that you've designated these decks cake and header. Amazing. Very good. Made me giggle when I saw that. But yeah, I love the interpretation of this hexagram in terms of Strike's essential nature and change, because that is at the core of this book, the change he's going through. In addition to that, I think that we can think about the UHC through this hexagram, because hexagram 48 refers to the political structures that people create to organize their lives and to meet their human needs. And these structures, these social, political, religious structures, can change their shape and form, like the town. But the well itself, which is the fundamental needs and nature of human beings, does not change. So any satisfactory organizing structure, like a government or a church, needs to satisfy the deepest needs of the people who are living in it. And the UHC claims to do this, but it does not. It claims to work for the benefit of the whole, but it absolutely does not. The UHC is poisoning the well.
Yeah.
Also, I'd like to note this passage, going back to Strike and your point. This passage from the interpretation of 48 says, if a well is being lined with stone, it cannot be used while the work is going on, but the work is not in vain. The result is that the water stays clear. In life also, there are times when a man must put himself in order. During such a time, he can do nothing for others, but his work is nonetheless valuable, because by enhancing his powers and abilities through inner development, he can accomplish all the more later on. And is this not speaking exactly to what Corman has been doing with himself? He has been lining his well with stone to better be able to connect with and be with other people. He's the superior man. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be referring to Strike as the superior man a lot in this season. Yeah. It is a very sexy term for him.
Big same. Love that.
Superior man energy. SME.
All right, should we start with chapter one?
Yes,
chapter one.
So in chapter one, we see the christening of Nick and Ilsa's son.
So the epigraph for this one, the superior man is careful of his words and temperate in eating and drinking. And that's from hexagram 27, the corners of the mouth.
I have to say that I am loving how much more straightforward the epigraphs for this book are, because I'm pretty sure that this one is just referring to Strike's noticeable efforts to lose weight.
Yeah. We learned at the end of the chapter how successful he's been with his diet. 3 stone is a lot of weight.
That's so much.
Yeah. Yes. For those who don't know, because we don't use stone here, but that's 14 pounds. So he's lost 42 pounds. That is great. Mm-hmm. And you know, the epigraph also says that the superior man is careful with his words. I guess you can apply that to Strike not saying his thoughts about Murphy out loud.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of wish he would have.
This epigraph just reminds me, we were talking about this just a few minutes ago. Have y'all noticed that every single epigraph in this book that's referring to the superior man are always Strike chapters, with the exception of this one Robin chapter, which is chapter 46. So that one talks about someone having an inner relationship with a superior man, which is super appropriate since it's the first time that Robin mentions using Strike to keep a foothold in reality.
Yeah, you know, I noticed it. I text you immediately as soon as I realized that this was a thing, because it's amazing. And the mm-hmm. fact that the only time it's not a Strike chapter is in the context that you've explained, it makes me absolutely certain that she did this intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
Who is Strike superior to? I mean,
take your pick.
Yeah, really.
There's a long list, a very long list in these books.
Yeah, I will say that I did notice that while I was listening to the book for my second read, that there are some epigraphs that have the phrase inferior man with a Strike chapter, but I'm almost positive that in context, it's referring to a different man in that chapter. So for mm-hmm. example, I think one of those times is when he interviews Jordan Rainey, and it's clear that Rainey is the inferior man. Yeah. But yeah, I really, really like Strike being called the superior man, obviously.
I'm shocked.
It's right up there with Joe using the epigraphs to compare him to the champion of true justice in Troubled Blood.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's so fun because I feel like she says so much to us in these epigraphs about how she feels about these two, you know, mm-hmm. how she sees them. At least I think that's what's happening.
I mean,
sometimes.
One of them, she refers to them like a married couple.
I know. Yes, I actually, that happens two times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're so right. The I Ching is about, it's providing judgments. These epigraphs seriously feel like the voice of the author judging her own characters for us, which is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. Also, can I just say, and this is, yeah, apropos of nothing, this hexagram is composed of mountain over thunder, the two trigrams that are arranged on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
So it's mountain above thunder. Just the image of Strike as a mountain of a man with the crashing power of thunder underneath. I gotta say, it's doing something for me. Like the nature imagery, it's...
I'm picturing Zeus throwing lightning bolts or something.
Okay, yeah. So now it's funny. Now I'm thinking about Hercules, but yeah. Okay. Yeah, fair enough.
No, I mean, I get what you mean.
You get what I mean, right? The power
of
it,
I do.
The mass.
He's a superior man.
Very superior. Oh boy.
Anyway, I could not believe it when I read the first sentence of this chapter and he's actually holding a baby.
Right?
Could not believe
the
our
first
luck.
Sentence.
We said we wanted it, but I never actually thought we'd get it. Definitely yeah. less sentimental than we were going with, but I think that's usually the case for us with a lot of things.
Yeah, true. We want the sentiment, but Jo keeps it very understated. She subverts our expectations, and it turns out so good. But the moment I realized that the very first sentence of the book was giving us baby holding Strike, I was like, all right, buckle up. I knew that this book was going to be insane.
Yeah, I was fully expecting for Joe to gloss over this just because we want it so badly. But so when we actually got it, it was so exciting. Not to mention the image of Strike holding a small baby is really freaking cute.
I bet the baby looks extra tiny when Strike is holding him.
Oh my God.
Lindsay, how dare you? Oh, why would you say that?
Stop it with his enormous hands cradling the tiny baby head. Fuck off.
Yeah.
God. Also, how cute is it that the baby's name is Benji? That's a cute name.
I'm just so happy for them in general.
But poor Strike, I think he's probably stuck in what he considers an actual nightmare because yeah. he's holding this screaming baby with no end in sight, cornered by three women asking him all kinds of questions. The heater is right at his back and the cherry on top, Ryan Murphy is there.
Oh my God. What did poor Strike do to be punished in this way?
I know.
Although it sounds like an actual nightmare for me too. I'm not going to lie. This does not sound fun at
Seriously,
all.
It strikes personal hell.
I actually feel really overwhelmed on his behalf because I can get overwhelmed when my baby's crying and won't stop. So I can imagine having a screaming baby while three people are talking at you.
Oof.
There's nothing he could have done to stop that baby from crying because he was hungry.
He don't got no milk.
No, unless he starts producing milk, there's nothing he can do. Just a horrible Why? Image.
That's a horrific image. Thanks a lot. Yikes.
Anyway, these women, though, someone, I think it was Lamp on Twitter, made a joke that we were all kind of like these women with Strike, but just on Twitter, which is fair. It's fair. Mm-hmm, but I'd like to think that in real life, I'd have a little more tact and realize he's not loving this.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, since he's fictional, I don't mind talking about his BDE on Twitter or potentially Harry anything.
Yeah. Yeah, anything. No, I would never do this to someone in real life.
No, of course not.
Were these women, were they raised in barns?
I have to say, though, that as annoying as this is for Strike, Strike's internal response to the person asking about the Ripper case, no, I did it all telepathically, really made me laugh.
Yeah. That was really funny.
So in our predictions episode in the sample section, we talked about the possibility of seeing some Troubled Blood parallels with this book. If you listened to us last season, you'll know that we talked a lot about the Lethal White parallels with Ink Black Heart, and I think we're going to have to do this again with the Running Grave and Troubled Blood because I noticed a lot of them. I'm not really sure if I think it means anything or even if I think I'm right because I've seen other thoughts from people about parallels to other books and it's starting to feel like maybe it's just because, you know, it's a series, so we're going to see these connections. I don't know.
This book it felt so full of callbacks to all of the other books in this series. But I agree with you. There are a ton of specific Troubled Blood parallels that we got to figure out what it means. To me, this book kind of feels like it's wrapping up an arc. It's revisiting beginnings in order to be the start of something new, if that makes sense. Like, it's bringing it all full circle and then we're jetting off in a new direction. But yeah, you know, I feel like it does mean something.
There were things that were really specific to me.
In any case, let's put a pin in it and we'll keep an eye out for it for the rest of the season.
But for right now, this reminded me of Joan's funeral when those two women were doing exactly what these women are doing. And he's also not loving it.
Oh, yeah.
That's where I was going with that.
And at both events, he had a brief connection with Robin, but not nearly as much of one as he wanted to have. And also Ilsa was there.
One of those women at the funeral was named Abigail, by the way.
Well, that's spooky.
Okay, I guess we have to talk about Bijou.
Can we not? Can we just return Bijou for store credit? Like, I don't want her here anymore.
God, it's going to be like when you return an item, but it's been marked down so you don't get full price.
Outrageous.
It's not very nice, but...
Well, okay, Bijou's not very nice, so I feel That's justified.
True. That's true. If I'm being honest, though, I'm kind of glad this happened because we got a vow out of it.
We do love a vow.
And we got to see Robin picturing things, so I'm fine with this. In the end, I'm okay with it.
In the end, everything does happen for a reason when you're being written by a brilliant author.
Yes.
And sometimes that reason is an imaginary picture of a hairy ass.
Yeah, great reason.
How many episodes this season are we going to mention the hairy ass thing?
It's another part of the drinking game, yeah.
Yeah.
Also, I feel like Strike would have been just a little too perfect without this Bijou slip up, you know?
Can't believe that after everything we went through in Ink Black Heart with him, we could now be thinking he's too perfect. But a bit of backsliding is understandable and expected. Change is hard.
He was almost perfect.
Almost.
It was a direct contrast to his rock bottom in Ink Black Heart.
Definitely. Aww.
Anyway, back to the actual chapter. Strike leaves to give the baby back to Ilsa. Do you think that Ilsa knew how much Strike would hate it if she took Robin with her, leaving him alone with Murphy?
Mm-hmm.
She did. I'm not sure why she wants to torture Strike. Why give him the baby to hold? There's gotta be better choices, but she clearly is torturing him for some reason.
I would guess he's probably one of the people she knows the best, except for her mother, and she was drunk.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, maybe don't let the drunk lady hold the baby.
Yeah, or people you don't know very well. Anyway, he's not alone with Murphy for long because Nick shows up and we get that hilarious line about renouncing Satan.
I love that line. We had a good run. I died laughing. Strike is very funny.
He is funny. This book was one of the funniest of the series for me, and I have to wonder if she did that on purpose to counter the intense anxiety of Robin being inside the UHC, you know, because the humor was really good.
Yeah, the humor in this book is especially good, isn't it? I feel like Strike in particular has some like really good zingers.
If I start now, I'm just gonna quote all my favorite funny lines.
I know, that's
we gotta wait till we get to them.
Okay, so Bijou has turned up, and I want to talk about Murphy looking Bijou up and down, because when we got the sample, we all thought, oh, this relationship is doomed. It's not going to last past this book because of things like this.
Yeah.
So do you think that we're going to get a darker side to Murphy in the next book? Do you know what I mean? So him looking at Bijou, Wardle saying he's a mean drunk who will hit on any woman. Mm-hmm. It feels like a lot of setup that didn't come to anything yet.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think the fact that he wasn't done in this book the way he thought he would be proves that all of this setup is going somewhere, because he's a two-book character now. This is a full-on arc with him. And I have a feeling that Joe has something substantial planned for his character in book 8, which means, sadly, that I don't think he's getting dumped and just disappearing in the prologue.
Bummer.
But all of these hints are definitely going to come to fruition in the next book. I feel it in my soul.
Exactly. There's too much unfinished business that I want to see. Mm-hmm. I want to see Robin make the right choice this time, as opposed to when her choice was marrying Matthew, which totally makes me think of that line in Career of Evil when Strike thinks about being the alternative.
Oh my God.
But I think there are things that will happen first inside her mind and her heart, but I think it's going to include a side dish of drama from Murphy and these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Yeah, I have to say that I am so ready for the absolute mess that book eight is bound to be with regard to Murphy and Robin.
It's going to be messy.
So messy. Oh my goodness. The whole mean, drunk, aggressive flirt comment that we get later definitely feels like a setup for something more, not just something to give a little bit more seasoning to Blandy McBlanderson's character.
Murphy is like all the fish strike eight in this book, you know, just so blah, and I'm sick of it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm sick of the fish. I have leftover fish from last night in the fridge.
Nobody wants fish.
I don't
want to
eat it. No.
We want the steak. Murphy's the fish. We want the steak. But the chapter ends with them all deciding that they need to take pictures of the cake before they eat it, and Strike telling Nick that he's lost 3 stone, which I was so happy.
Yeah, I was so happy for him. He's done such a good job.
The ending of this chapter is so incredible.
We get the beginning of the petty, jealous Strike and his hilarious internal monologue throughout the book, which is an absolute gift. I love it so much.
Honest to God, one of the best parts of this book.
Yeah.
How do we not put it into read?
Yeah, really. What's wrong with us?
Somebody read it.
3 stone, said Strike. Good going, said Murphy, slim and fit in his single-breasted suit. Fuck off, you smug bastard.
Oh my God. I don't know if y'all have seen the video of Joe reading the ending of this chapter, but it cracks me up when she gets to this part, because you know she must have had so much fun writing that line.
Yeah, I enjoyed that as well.
Yeah.
Also, I have to say, good job to you, Pools, because this is another thing I think you got right in predictions. Ooh. So you had wondered if this book opening up with the baptism was going to reflect something in the cult, and it absolutely does.
Mm-hmm.
We get many instances of UHC baptism, and Robin almost died in that pool. So good job spotting that.
What can I say? I'm a genius.
Chapter 2.
Robin and Ilsa have a chat, and Strike and Robin talk about the case.
The epigraph for chapter 2 reads, 6 in the 5th place means the companion bites his way through the wrappings. If one goes to him, how could it be a mistake? From hexagram 38, opposition.
So here's something that I'm curious about. What do you think is the significance of the ones where it'll say 6 in the 5th place means? Mm. Because she could just put the other part, right? So is there a reason that she left this in?
Yeah, my theory is that she leaves these in because in the I Ching, they're referring to changing lines. So the lines of the hexagram can be stable or they can be changing. And the changing lines indicate moments of tension where change is coming. So perhaps she leaves these in because this situation that the epigraph is referring to is something where change is happening or is about to happen, rather than to a stable situation.
Okay.
Or just because the excerpt comes not from the main hexagram, but from the line interpretations. Hmm. I don't know. Could be.
So I was having a bit of trouble making a direct connection between this particular passage and the chapter. But when I looked at the other decks, the hexagram as a whole kind of made sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
So my cake deck said, when people have fundamental differences that cannot be compromised, opposition is inevitable. Small things may be accomplished with care, but expect no success in any great endeavor as long as the players remain the same. And to me, this was just screaming Murphy and Robin, because we're introduced to a major fundamental difference in this chapter when we learn that he really wants kids.
Mm-hmm.
So we're seeing this fundamental difference in this relationship, and there's no possibility for long-term success here. We all know that. But I'm hoping that, Pools, you could make some more sense of the actual passage, though.
I feel like there are a lot of oppositions in this chapter going on. So you've got Robin and Ilsa, you've got Robin and Murphy, you've got Cormoran and Murphy, Robin and Cormoran, and each of these pairs are sort of separated in some way, whether by a refusal to open up or petty internal loathing of the other. But like you said, in the deck, oppositions like this, they can be obstructions when people have different points of view that diverge. They can't work together to come to a singular purpose. So Robin and Ryan. But also in this hexagram, it states that some oppositions can be fruitful when they're reconciled. So the hexagram speaks specifically of the duality of heaven and earth, spirit and nature, man and woman. These oppositions can work together to bring about creation. And I think that the actual lines in the epigraph are referring to the pair of Strike and Robin in their opposition, because this line is explained with the words, coming upon a sincere man, one fails to recognize him at first because of the general estrangement. However, he bites his way through the wrappings that are causing the separation. When such a companion thus reveals himself in his true character, it is one's duty to go to meet with him and to work with him. Carmen is a sincere man here with Robin. There is that slight estrangement between them because of Murphy and the love for each other that they're both hiding. But Carmen is doing the work in this novel to reveal himself to her. That's what's changing. And Robin must go to him to meet him and work with him and to love him and to reconcile their opposition and bring order to the world. Does that make sense?
Yes. And I have to go cry.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, we open up the chapter with Ilsa and Robin in the room while Ilsa feeds the baby. And right away, she's complaining about Bijou. I really, really love how much Ilsa despises this woman because
same. I desperately want to have a wine night with Ilsa and listen to all her salt about everyone in her chambers and her idiot friends because she's so amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Although if I were her, I'd have been extremely careful about not issuing invitations within earshot of a nutter like this. Like, that's basic nutter precautions, right?
It really is. Yeah. Yeah. This all could have been avoided.
Yes.
It's so weird, though, to assume that you'd be invited to something like that when you don't know the person. Bijou is just
the worst.
The most cringy a person could be.
I can't understand how someone behaves like
that. Why would she even want to go?
It seems like her primary motivation is to, like, pick up men. And a christening doesn't seem like the right kind of place for it.
Well, I guess it was.
She's trying it. Yeah. Also, I love all the little things that Joe throws in at the beginning of these books to set up first-time readers for later events and to sort of refresh our memory about stuff. So in this case, the bit about breastfeeding serves to mention that Robin is from a farming family, which sets us up for her time at Chapman Farm and her knowledge about farming and livestock coming in useful later.
Yeah, you're so right. So here's where Ilsa asks how things are going with Ryan. And seeing that they had been together for 8 months was, again, I think we talked about this before, but a bit of a gut punch.
Part of me cannot believe that Robin has let this drag on for almost a year. But the other part of me can absolutely believe it. I mean, Carmen and Lorelai were together for over a year. I guess that when there's no insane drama, a relationship just sort of happens. And then you blink and look up and suddenly it's February.
And the comparison to Lorelai is a good one, especially with the I love yous.
That had better not mean that we've got to get through a Robin Madeline and then a Robin Bijou.
I think the things that they need in themselves to get over are different.
Different. Yes. Mm-hmm. You're so right, Lindsay. You always make me feel better.
But anyway, I love Ilsa here. She's so funny. I love that she clearly knows Cormoran so well to know how much he's hating this.
I would have loved to see his face at Robin and Ryan holding hands.
I know.
Oh.
Poor guy. It must have been really frustrating for Ilsa too, because she and Robin had this, you know, mostly open conversation at Bob Ricard last year, and now Robin has just completely put her wall back up. It's frustrating for me.
Yeah, for me too. Mm-hmm. And I know that Robin has done this because, you know, she wants to be loyal to Ryan and would feel way too guilty about indulging with chat about how much she loves Strike with Ilsa. But it's so sad to me. Like, come on, Robin. You must be aware that this whole falling out of love thing isn't working. Or is she just that out of touch with her own feelings that she believes it is?
I know Robin says that she wants to feel loyal to Ryan, but I can't help but wonder if the truer reason is not wanting to admit she's dating someone while she knows she's in love with Strike, because I think she is still aware from what we see in, I think it's chapter 6. So I think she's just pushing it down because it's not a thing you want to admit.
Yeah, when you're in love with someone else, it's kind of a shitty thing to do, as we've seen with Strike in the last how many novels.
Now, because these walls have come back up, do you think that Robin is going to tell Ilsa about what Strike told her at the end of the book? Because that's something I've been wondering about a lot. Though if Strike does, RIP to all of us.
I've been wondering about this too. I actually think that it's more likely that Strike would tell her or someone, because he has made the choice to try and be happy. He might actually ask for some advice.
I would love to see that.
So next, Ilsa mentions that Murphy told her earlier that he wants kids. And there's a lot to unpack here, I think, because
so much.
Oh my
God. Robin's response that they've barely known each other for 8 months is really funny to me. I feel like when you're dating in your 30s, you should maybe know at 8 months if you want something more with that person, right?
Yeah.
It's very telling that she's not thinking about a future with him.
Yeah. 8 months in your 30s when you've both been married and divorced before.
Yeah.
Like, that's the time frame for serious consideration about the future. But since Robin is about to basically disappear on him for 4 months, she's clearly not in that space.
She's so unemotional about this relationship. I think the strongest emotion we ever see her display with Murphy is anger.
Oh, yeah. And the fact that she still wonders whether or not she might actually be in love with him anyway later on, despite this, so frustrating.
I was thinking about this the other day because we've always been excited at the prospect of Strike using the word love because of his vow to not use it unless, you know?
Mm-hmm. We recall, yes.
Yeah, but with Robin, we mostly see her pretending or not sure what love is. Mm-hmm. So I'm starting to think that we've had this moment with Strike where he said it because he finally knows what he feels and what he wants. But with Robin, it's going to be a certainty that what she feels for him is love. Like, there's not going to be any more wondering if something is love. She's going to know it. I think we're going to see that some point in the next book.
Yeah, I hope so.
I don't know
so.
If that makes sense, but...
It makes sense. It's crazy to me that she had the moment in Inkblot Heart where she said, I'm in love with him. And she's backsliding on it. She's like, oh, well, maybe this is what love feels like. A completely bland relationship with this guy she clearly doesn't actually care that much about. And I'm like, Robin, you know what
we're going to get that. Like. I mean, this is going to pay off. It's going to pay off in the way that Strike saying he's not going to say he loves someone until it's going to pay off.
Well, now we're back to the end of the book again. Take a drink. All right.
Anyway, back to Ilsa. She says that Cormor never wanted kids. And to me, this implies that at some point, Robin has talked to Ilsa about the fact that she doesn't think she wants children. And that's why Ilsa is using it to show Robin that she is compatible with Strike and not Murphy.
Mm-hmm. That definitely seems possible slash probable to me. I feel like this whole conversation is Ilsa poking Robin repeatedly in different places with a sort of metaphorical stick, just trying to get her to respond about something, trying to provoke her, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she could just be poking. It's a risky thing to poke about if you don't know the answer.
It sure is.
Which tells me that I think that Ilsa does know the answer.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be surprised if Ilsa has casually asked her before if she wanted kids and just filed the no away in the back of her mind so that she could use it for future use, like the brilliant lawyer she is.
Oh, totally.
I'm now imagining Ilsa with a binder. She has a notepad. Binder labeled Strike. And Robin, and she's got like all the information she's collected. She's got her plots. It's basically a murder board in a binder, just like us, I guess. Oh boy.
That's why she's the captain of our ship.
She's Captain Ilsa.
Love her.
I think that you're for sure right. Aside from just foreshadowing reasons, I think it's a good thing that Ilsa's pointing out something that makes them fundamentally incompatible, because that's just a good thing to do. I mean, they're friends.
Yeah.
But Robin isn't really in a place to hear that in this book. You know, meanwhile, Robin's over here making like a camel and stuffing her head in the sand.
I thought that was ostriches.
Yes, an ostrich.
Is it ostriches? Yeah, I thought it was camels.
Yeah.
I don't think camels.
Hold on a second. Is it camels or ostrich?
It's an ostrich.
It's not camels. Make like a camel and store all her water in her hump.
Christ, okay.
Animal facts edition. So entertaining to me.
Oh my God. Okay. Well, in any case, Robin is over here sticking her head in the sand and just completely ignoring everything that Ilsa is saying. I'm glad to have provided you with such rich entertainment pools. Like, I can see you over there, like, trying to keep.
My cheeks hurt now. Oh my God.
I'm trying to imagine how a camel would even dig his.
I don't know, man.
Well, I guess their necks are kind of long, but like.
And they live in the desert.
Yeah.
That's
strong logic. Oh, I'm good.
Oh my goodness.
I'm good.
Okay. This is something we could talk about more later, but one thing I was really interested to see was how Robin behaved in a relationship. It was one of my predictions that we'd see her behaving similarly to Strike in a relationship, but I think the only way they're really similar is that they stay with the wrong person. Strike might be emotionally closed off, or I don't know, maybe even a little cold, like with Lorelai saying she loved him, but Robin, she pretends that she feels the same way, or she tries to tell herself she does. And I think that's kind of worse you know?
Yeah. Of course, they are similar in other patterns of behavior. They're so avoidant of any kind of real emotional intimacy or conflict. They both lie rather than have uncomfortable confrontations. Yeah, mostly about each other.
Yeah, I know. Well, Strike didn't lie to Lorelai and say he loved her too.
That's true.
But I agree that they're similar in a lot of ways with this whole thing.
Yeah.
I think the biggest thing they're both doing is repeating mistakes.
Yeah.
And Strike is ahead of her now because of his vow. But this book was Strike's turn to overcome the past and his past mistakes. And I think that it'll be Robin's turn next book.
It better be.
Anyway, my point here about kids is that I don't think it would be totally unreasonable for Murphy to be upset to learn that Robin has known that he wants kids and never said that she didn't.
Yeah. If he's made it clear that this is something he wants, I can see him being reasonably annoyed by that.
I can imagine there being quite a lot of resentment over the wasted time. Like I was saying earlier, their inevitable breakup is going to be the messiest.
I can't wait for it. Remember how chapter 55 of Lethal White felt? I literally cheered when Robin left Matthew. I'm hoping for something that brings me the same amount of joy that did. You know,
I can imagine it now.
It was joyful.
It was.
Let's go back to Ilsa. She mentioned Charlotte, and this is our first mention of Charlotte in this book. I was really intrigued by Robin's assessment that Charlotte had looked strangely blank and glassy-eyed.
It was this moment that made me so confident in predicting her death by suicide this book, because it's such a clear detail that she is in a bad place mentally, that she's visibly on drugs. It doesn't bode well. It's very much setting up Charlotte as a big part of this book's story with such a significant mention early on. That's what these chapters are for, right? Bringing in all of the elements that are going to thread through the rest of the book.
Yeah, I was completely fooled by the messing with Robin ideas. Even later in the book with her last voicemail threats about, you know, going after Robin.
Oh yeah, those threats were scary, especially when Strike was mentioning in his own internal monologue that he was wishing he hadn't fucked with Murphy whenever they met up to talk about guns on the farm.
I think that's why her suicide was such a shock to me, because I was fully expecting her to mess with Robin somehow. And then it was just like, oh, well, that's not happening.
Nope.
Imagine if Robin got home and she had voicemails from Charlotte.
Oh my God.
Horrific.
That would have been so good.
It would have been really good.
I wish. Sadly, we know she didn't, because she's been home for a while. But maybe Charlotte left a letter to be delivered conveniently in the time frame of the next book somehow. You know, like the packages from the past that arrive in the future.
Yeah.
Magic. Maybe she went back in time and delivered it with those roses and Career of Evil or whatever.
They were from Charlotte all along.
They were from future Charlotte all along.
Wow. Okay.
Wow.
So here's where Nick comes in, and I remember going no when he said that Bijou was flirting with Strike.
I feel like it definitely got Robin's attention, though. We don't get her thoughts when he says it, but I'm certain that she felt a stab of something.
Yeah.
And we don't get the moment of Robin leaving the room, but I'm certain that she hustled out of there to find Strike as soon as she could.
Well, even later when she finds out that he slept with her, it says she feels hurt.
Yeah.
Ilsa's method here is not good, though. Telling Nick to warn him, he clearly didn't.
Does Ilsa have to do everything herself? The woman just gave birth. Can we not give her a break in her tireless, selfless crusade to find happiness for two beautiful idiots?
I feel like we can no longer, after this book, Strike is not in that category anymore.
He's no longer a dum-dum. He's now a smart man.
A superior man.
Yeah.
If I was Ilsa, instead of going to Strike and telling him don't date her, because we know how that worked out, I'd just go up to him and just start telling him that woman told me that she tried to steal her married boyfriend's sperm so she can get him to leave his wife. I would just leave it. I feel like that would have done the trick.
So would have. He would have been keeping a 6-foot distance between them at all times. He would be social distancing 4 years early.
Yeah, just in case she's really good at secretly stealing sperm.
She's a witch. A witch stealing the sperm. He's protected.
That one sentence would have done it.
She needs to graphically tell him the story about Bijou picking the condom out of the garbage.
Yes, exactly.
She wouldn't even need to tell Strike. She could just tell Robin when Strike's standing next to her.
Yes.
God,
come on, Ilsa.
Get it together. You're a lawyer.
Anyway, it cuts to Bijou talking to Strike. I really thought that all of the names that she was dropping were going to come up later. I thought that they would need her help to get some sort of contact, but she'd be bitter because Strike rejected her.
I really love, though, how Strike is so obviously spending this entire conversation looking for Robin. So it mentions him looking around and seeing that Ryan's gone. He catches Nick's eye as soon as Nick enters the kitchen, and he sees Robin the moment that she does because he was watching for her.
Yeah. Going back to Bijou, though, I really don't know what to say about her ridiculous story about push-up bras and going commando in court, except that I liked the line where Strike thinks about how he could just imagine Robin and Midge's reaction if he suggested the same.
Midge's response would be absolute gold. You know that she'd suggest he find some assless chaps and bend over himself, right? Like, that is exactly what she would say. And I'm cracking up just thinking about it.
You know what? I'd forgive a lot if she said that. I would take back everything I said.
You're okay with insubordination when it involves assless chaps, I guess.
I guess so.
That checks out.
Yeah, see, then we can all know for certain whether or not he has a hairy ass.
Yeah, we sure would.
It is a mystery that I now need solved, you know?
Robin is the best suited person for that. She can solve that mystery.
Anyway, let's move on because we all love this next bit. It says, at this moment, Robin reappeared in the kitchen alone. Strike's eyes followed her as she slid through the crowd to Nick to tell him something. He'd rarely seen Robin wear her strawberry blonde hair up, and it suited her. Her light blue dress was far more demure than Bijou's and looked new. Bought in tribute to Master Benjamin Herbert, Strike wondered, or for the benefit of Ryan Murphy. As he watched, Robin turned, saw him, and smiled over the sea of heads.
Oh my God, he's so in love with her, admiring her hair and her dress. Jealous speculation. Bless him.
It's very sweet. Him watching her this way reminds me of the way he watches her in Skegness without realizing it. But this time she catches him doing it and just smiles at him.
Oh my God, yes.
It's very sweet.
And he's allowing himself to watch her here.
I love that he didn't let Bijou hold him there for a single second that he could have been spending with Robin instead.
Literally leaves her mid-sentence.
Yeah. Also, he notes that there had been no time to talk at the church. I'm amazed that he didn't at least whisper something to her to make her laugh at some point. I guess he was taking the whole renouncing Satan thing very seriously.
Listen, renouncing Satan is very serious business.
I wonder if they were both aware of Murphy watching from the crowd, because I bet he'd be so jealous if he's looking and Strike whispers and makes her laugh.
And Murphy's thoughts would probably be right along the same as Strike's later. There's no way he's that fucking funny.
Except Murphy would be wrong because Strike is hilarious.
Yeah, Strike is hilarious. Robin would have had a very hard time keeping a straight face and not cracking up if Strike was trying to make her laugh at that baptism.
Let's talk about this bit where Robin resents feeling self-conscious when she's talking about Murphy. It says she ought to be able to talk naturally about her boyfriend with her best friend, but given Strike's lack of warmth on the rare occasions Murphy called her at the office, she found it difficult. I cannot believe that beneath all that denial, Robin doesn't understand why there's a lack of warmth, especially after Ilsa just brought it up.
Yeah, I'm side-eyeing Robin hard
here. Me too.
She must know. She's just being willfully blind.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
The denial is strong with this one.
So here's our first mention of Little John. Robin complains how quiet he is. Knowing what we know now, it's kind of a weird choice to make yourself so unlikable when you're there to spy. Shouldn't you try more to fit in?
You'd think, right? Maybe he's just super uncomfortable with the whole being a spy thing.
Yeah, maybe. Which kind of implies that he might not be a terrible man, just a desperate one.
Yeah.
So then here's our first mention of Pat, and it's great for a couple reasons. Because first, we love her.
Amen. Yes.
The level of love for Pat, the limit does not exist.
It does not exist.
Joe did promise that we would not be disappointed in Pat.
Understatement of the year.
But I have to go back to Troubled Blood here, because when we're introduced to Pat in Troubled Blood, Strike and Robin are also talking about their new subcontractor, Morris. And let me just read this quote from Troubled Blood. So it says, Pat likes him, she added, partly out of mischief, and was amused to see out of the corner of her eye Strike turn to look at her scowling. And then a little later, it says Patricia Chauncey was 56 and looked 65. And then let's compare that with The Running Grave, where Strike and Robin are now talking about Little John. Pat doesn't like him, said Robin. Pat was the agency's office manager, an implausibly black-haired, chain-smoking woman of 58 who looked at least a decade older. I don't go to Pat for character judgment, said Strike. So I like this as a little troubled blood callback to Pat's opinions on their subcontractors. It's funny that we know how wrong Pat was about Morris. So I wonder if we're meant to wonder if her dislike of Little John was also wrong.
I'm sure that's another trying to fake us out moment. But my only conclusion can be, like Strike, I can't go to Pat for consistently accurate judgments about character.
It's also just a very direct, there are two very direct parallels there with the Pat likes him, Pat doesn't like him, and then the mention of her looking 10 years older.
Yep.
And I also loved this bit. He noticed the office manager's warmth towards Ryan Murphy whenever the CID man turned up to pick Robin up from the office and didn't appreciate it. Irrationally, he felt everyone at the agency should feel as hostile to Murphy as he did.
You'd think that this would be basic loyalty. Genuinely, being on Team Ryan should count as insubordination. Treason.
Anyone who's Team Ryan is automatically ineligible for a pay rise or a bonus that year.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
I mean, out of loyalty is how I felt before the book. And now it's more that I just don't like him.
Yes.
You know, but jealous Strike is hilarious. And it almost makes me wonder if Pat is going to become Strike's ally after his little we'll see.
I am so curious about this as well. Yeah. Her love of handsome men and conventional love stories versus her loyalty and her friendship with Strike. Like, what will win?
Yeah, I want to see her rooting for Strike. That would be really cute.
I do too. I've been hoping for that without realizing that I've been hoping for that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. It would be really nice.
Now they go back to talking about the case, and I love this bit. If we take the job, it might mean one of us going under deep cover. I can't do it. The leg's too distinctive. Probably have to be Midge. She's not married. Nor am I, said Robin quickly.
Quickly. Ooh. I was sipping my tea in this 8-month relationship over here.
Yeah, quick to say, I'm not attached.
Mm-mm, no, I'm totally free to go dive into a cult for 4 months.
Yeah, the whole thing is just so funny because Robin thinks he's testing her commitment to the job. And really, he's testing her commitment to Murphy.
How can she possibly think that Strike still doubts her commitment to the job at this point?
Seriously. I don't know.
It must be a willful refusal to consider Strike's jealousy that's making her think this. There's no rational reason
it has to be, because it's absolutely infuriating that she thinks this.
Yes.
And then when Murphy comes back in and Robin steps away from Strike automatically, I was like, Robin, you're putting yourself in the same situation.
Exact same. How close are they standing, by the way? Can we get it measured in like inches?
Or I know.
Give us more detail.
Hair touching.
Oh, God. Okay, I'm good. I'm sorry, I was just thinking of some of my favorite moments from this book again.
I know.
Flashing through my head like a montage. And
that's just how it is on repeat. Every day.
Yeah.
Did J.K. Rowling know what she was about to do when she gave us this book?
Oh, yeah.
I think she did.
Strike drops the grenade at the end. I feel like the running grave was Joe's grenade. She was like, here you go.
Grenade. There goes all higher brain function for the next 6 months, I guess.
Anyway, not just that they're standing close together, but that Murphy's eyes are all alert.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's not wrong to be alert about them. He senses something between them that's absolutely there.
Yeah, like, no, he's definitely not wrong. But look, I'm going to have a lot to say about Murphy as we go through this book, because like I said, I like him a whole lot less than I did before I reread it. But I won't say that he's wrong to be jealous.
Mm-mm.
But that also doesn't mean that you can't see the controlling bit start to come out when he's trying to catch her in a lie and stuff like that.
100%. Yeah.
The chapter ends with them taking a picture all together with the baby in front of the cake. And there are two things that happened that make me feel so much secondhand embarrassment. First is Murphy telling Robin in front of so many people that holding a baby suits her. I died a little inside for her.
So much cringe.
I hated that.
Yeah, that's gross. Do we think that part of his motivation for doing this is claiming his territory in front of Strike, so to speak?
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. Just like Matthew with the boob grabbing.
Yeah. Ugh. God, don't remind me about Matthew.
I'm sorry, but that just makes me like him even less.
My life has been so happy without Matthew in it, and you got to bring him back into my brain?
I really liked the one review of The Running Grave that came out before the book that said it was the reddest of red flags for J.K. Rowling to compare Murphy to Matthew so many times.
Matthew's a walking red flag.
I don't remember the wording, but it was like, no one hates their own character more than she hates Matthew. It was so good.
Oh, it was good.
But yeah, and then the second thing that happened is Bijou pushing her way to be in the picture.
God, I can't believe she did that. I can't believe no one pushed her back out. Like,
I'm sorry, I'm just imagining Strike as large as he is, like going. Like, It's literally one of the most awkward things that's happened to me in these books. Well, not to me, but that I had to experience. I cannot imagine being this kind of person.
I can't. That's nutter drawer behavior.
It is.
But at least we finally have a canonical picture of Carmen and Robin together.
Yeah, I know.
It would have been so much cuter if it had just been them standing in front of the office door. But I will take what I can get. At least Bijou's on the end of the row, so Robin can just sort of cut her off when she puts the picture on her mantelpiece.
I very much want her to put that up there.
Yeah, me too.
Notice how the final sentence of this chapter is how both Strike and Robin are jealous. So it says, Strike ruminating on what Murphy had just said, Robin noticing how Bijou leaned into her detective partner, determined to feature in the picture.
How's that falling out of love thing going for you, Robin? Is it going well? Is it going good?
It's not going well for her, no.
No.
Okay, chapter three.
Chapter three. Strike gets a call from Shanker and from Charlotte. The epigraph for this chapter, to be circumspect and not to forget one's armor is the right way to security. And that is from Hexagram 43, also known as Breakthrough/Resoluteness.
I really, really like this one. I think this epigraph is that Strike is considering his predicament of being in love with Robin, and he's thinking about what he might do, weighing his options. But at this point, he's still wearing a lot of his armor, as the epigraph says. He's still thinking about the fear he has of ruining their friendship and their business. But it's so beautiful when you think about how this comes back later, where at the end, he's no longer waiting around and hoping like he is in this chapter, but decides to make the effort and set his armor down and be vulnerable. So I love this chapter, and I love how the epigraph is showing us that while he's considering telling Robin how he feels, he's still afraid. But I love it even more now that we can see how this chapter is resolved at the end.
Aw, that's beautiful. I love that.
Yeah. This chapter is a great example of ring structure in the novel, and I think it's one of the reasons why I was completely convinced that he was going to tell Robin he was in love with her at the end.
Oh,
completely.
My gosh. Yes. I love this interpretation because, yes, keeping his armor on is the way to security. It's safer, but in the end, it's not the right way to happiness. Reaching happiness requires risk and vulnerability. It's not safe or secure, but it's so much more valuable than those things. And there's one bit of the hexagram in the book that I found very interesting when thinking about your reference to ring structure. And it was this. It refers to the time when inferior people gradually begin to disappear. Their influence is on the wane. As a result of resolute action, a change in condition occurs, a breakthrough. When we circle back to this at the end of the book, to Strike eventually taking off his armor, that's when the breakthrough and changing conditions happens. As a result of his resolute action, the inferior people can be read as, you know, the Ryan and the Bijou of the novel. Their influence is beginning to wane. They're on their way out. Some of them faster than others. And Strike is being set up here to, as you said, have his big breakthrough by the end of the book.
Yeah.
And I was also thinking about the way he tears up Bijou's phone number. That's sort of protecting himself too. Not that it works.
Since I just brought up ring structure, I also want to point out that the opening line of this chapter says that Strike is feeling vaguely depressed. And it also says that at the end. I mean, do we all agree that he's feeling this way because he's in love with Robin and just had to spend the whole day with Murphy around?
Absolutely. I mean, he had to see them holding hands. He had to be confronted with the idea of a Robin Murphy baby. Poor guy. It's a hard day for him, especially when he's already had to say so long to Satan. It's a bad day.
They had to call it quits for real this time. You know, those times with Timothy Anstis and his other godchild, they just didn't quite stick, you know, but third time's the charm.
When you lay it out like that and all of it, must have really hurt his heart to see them together. And then he had to have fish and broccoli for dinner.
Oh my
god,
adding insult to injury.
I know.
Ugh.
I mean, I was thinking after a day of having to watch them together, he deserved a little treat, you know.
Listen, I definitely would not have been able to stick with my diet after a day like that.
No.
I mean, his self-control and his discipline are very impressive.
Yeah, I mean, I'd look for any excuse.
Yeah, any excuse. I'm like, oh, I slept over my alarm by 10 minutes. Guess my diet for the day is gone. I can't handle this.
Did either of you laugh, though, when it said he put vegetables in a newly purchased steamer, since in the last book he had never heard of such a thing?
Like steaming? You can cook vegetables without frying them? Amazing.
It was so funny.
I wonder if he thinks about Robin teaching him that steamed veggies exist every time he uses it. I mean, mean, I feel like the odds are higher than zero on that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Him thinking about Robin is
I feel like he probably thinks about Robin like a lot of the time.
Yeah. Speaking of, so it says he's unsuccessfully trying not to think about Robin and about his realization that he's in love with her. And I love this bit that it says it was a problem that in truth he'd had far longer than he cared to admit. I'm not sure if we're ever going to get this, but one thing that I put on my ultimate wish list would be to see a conversation where they talked about when they think their feelings of love really started for each other, mm-hmm. mostly because I think that they were both in love with each other at her wedding. So mm-hmm. I'd just be really curious to hear what they think. I think that's why I like this line so much, because he's directly saying that, yeah, he's been in love with her for a really long time.
I too would love that, because I agree with you. I think they were both clearly in love with each other at the wedding. And now it's almost 5 years later, 5 years of being in love with each other and doing fuck all about it.
It's a lot of pining.
Let's talk about the fact that he used the word love.
Oh.
Love had arrived in a form he didn't recognize.
I screamed. We all screamed to each other on the internet about this.
I know. Besides feeling like I was about to bounce off the ceiling from excitement and happiness mm-hmm. from reading Strike use the word love, reading that it had arrived in a form he didn't recognize was as beautiful as it is sad. Do you know what I mean? Because mm-hmm. this love isn't pain for him, other than he can't act on it or doesn't know how she feels.
It is so sad, but it's also so hopeful for the future mm-hmm. of their relationship. You know, love is new for him because it's a true, healthy love. It's a good love. They're going to be so good with each other once they sort their shit out.
I think we're going to need an emotions closet break.
I did skip a little bit of this paragraph, though, and I think it's important not to skip over where he's still thinking about the risks and the fears, but even that is slightly different because he uses the past tense. So it says, for several years now, he'd told himself that an affair with his detective partner wasn't worth risking his most important friendship for or jeopardizing the business they'd built together. And then another line, if there were hardships and privations attached to a life lived resolutely alone in a small attic flat above his office, Strike had considered them a price well worth paying for independence and peace. So I think that it's saying that he's still afraid of these things, but he's finally at a place where he's considering that maybe it is worth it.
Completely agree. Past tense is showing his process of reconsidering the beliefs that he's held.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting when you talk about ring structure that he uses the past tense at the end of this book too, when he tells Robin, she knew I was in love with you, when we know it's very much an ongoing thing. And I don't know how the two connect, but it was just interesting in my mind.
We'll probably have to talk about the was a lot more, because I know people mm-hmm. have a lot of questions about that.
A lot.
What I keep coming back to is the fact that Strike, he did it intentionally. So even if Robin, like, what does that mean? Is he not anymore? Strike is going to set her straight at some point.
Mm-hmm. I think Robin knew exactly what he was saying.
I do too. Because
they can communicate on a level above mere words.
I'm not super worried about that.
She might take it as a chance to overthink.
Yeah. Robin?
Robin, overthink something?
No.
No.
Stop it.
I have to say, this whole thing about the was part mm-hmm. of his confession just reminds me of back in the Harry Potter days at the end of, I think it was book four, the shipping wars that erupted over, I think it was something around the end of the book and like a semicolon or something. Mm-hmm.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah
it does.
It seems like very much a J.K. Rowling fandom sort of thing for us to do, to obsess over,
and it means nothing,
particular grammar, and then it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, that mm-hmm. sounds absolutely
about right.
Right. So let's get to this next paragraph though, because I was so happy to read when it said, for the first time since he'd met Robin, Strike had no interest in pursuing a separate sexual relationship as a distraction from and a sublimation of any inconvenient feelings he might have for his partner. Again, I had hoped that this was a sign he wasn't going to sleep with Bijou.
Yeah.
But in hindsight, I still think it's a really big deal. It's really important because it seems to me like this part of himself is part of that self-disgust and seeing so quickly what an idiot he was being. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's still very important. This is still good.
It's definitely framing the Bijou thing as what it is. A momentary slip up, not an ongoing idiocy. His big brain is in the right place.
Yeah.
His little brain, maybe not so much.
Yeah, I think this is what helps us get that vow so early on in this book.
It is. It's also interesting that he uses the word sublimation, because that's a psychological term in Jungian therapy, it is generally seen as a positive coping mechanism, channeling your feelings about something into something else productive. But it has not been a positive coping mechanism for Strike. It's been a way to ignore his real feelings.
Yeah.
So it's just interesting you use such a specific psychological term that's associated with the Jungian therapy.
Mm-hmm. He still didn't know whether, in the event of Robin's relationship with Murphy ending, as he devoutly hoped it would, he'd force a conversation. He'd force a conversation he'd once have resisted to the utmost with a view to ascertaining Robin's own true feelings.
In hindsight, I feel like this line should have hinted to me that Murphy would still be around at the end of the book, because here, Strike is wrong in thinking that he needs to wait around, right?
Yeah.
And as I guess he did tell her that he loved her at the end, but in a much better way than he's thinking has to happen here. He doesn't wait around.
This bit here telegraphs directly his path of growth in this novel, from passively waiting for someone else to screw up to actively taking his fate and his happiness into his own hands.
Yeah.
We love to see it.
That's growth, baby.
That is growth, baby.
I think this is the biggest reason why I like Strike telling Robin he loves her while she's still dating Murphy. I know, Pools, you had explained your reasoning was that Strike sees Robin as her own person and not belonging to Murphy. Mm-hmm. But I think what it is for me is how much intent it shows from Strike. Mm-hmm. In this chapter, he's thinking he has to wait around for it to end. But the fact that he doesn't do that is so telling to us, and hopefully to Robin, that his intention is to be happy and build his life with her, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm going to like it for both reasons.
The goodness continues. It's hard not to read everything from this chapter. It's so good, right?
This season is just us reading the book. The unauthorized audiobook edition.
Uh-huh. We'd be the worst people to read the audiobook.
No, we'd be hilarious.
The objections to an affair with her remained. On the other hand, it suits you, that prick Murphy had said, seeing Robin with a baby in her arms. He feared the business partnership might break up in any case, because Robin would decide marriage and children appealed more than a detective career. So here stood Cormoran Strike, slimmer, fitter, clearer of lung, alone in his attic, poking broccoli angrily with a wooden spoon, thinking about not thinking about Robin Ellicott.
First of all, when it says that prick Murphy, I think it's Badly Wired Lamp who started this. She just refers to him as TPM. Mm-hmm. And I really like that.
Yes,
that's funny.
I think we talked about this after the sample came out, but just to go over it again, I think the importance of this line and him thinking about the possibility of Robin choosing marriage and children is significant in a really positive way, because he's worried he might lose her and risk the business if he tells her he loves her. But with this line, we see that he knows he might also lose her if he never acts.
Which makes the ending of this book even more incredible.
And that final line and the image it conjures of him angrily poking broccoli with a wooden spoon. It's so, so funny and so perfect. Yeah.
If we have any artists that listen to the show, this is one of those things that I feel like is begging to be drawn. Or even if you can't draw, I don't care, you know. But the description is so good.
It's so funny.
I still really, really want fan art of them at the end of Trouble Blood outside with all the flowers and her kissing him his cheek.
Yeah, we need more artists in this fandom. Mm-hmm.
Okay, but let's get to Shanker's phone call. I was excited that we were getting some more of Shanker, and it's going to be another thing I'm adding to this Troubled Blood parallel list.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm also going to add the subject of his phone call to the list as well, because cancer was obviously a big part of Troubled Blood with Joan's diagnosis, and here we're seeing it again with Angel.
Yeah.
I do want to point out this bit here where it's reintroducing Shanker, and it says he was probably the only human being who'd never seen any flaws in the incurably flighty, novelty-chasing Leda. This stood out to me because people have argued that Strike himself saw no flaws in Leda or looked at her with rose-tinted glasses, and I never fully agreed with that. I just thought that it was something that he didn't like to think about, but this hinted to me that we were going to see Strike actually thinking about her flaws, and I was really happy to see that happen in just a few chapters.
We have always seen Strike clearly knowing what Leda's flaws are. He prefers to put them aside as much as possible in favor of the positive when he's remembering her, right? Yeah. It's like he wants to dwell in that positive place.
And I'm wondering if the importance of his acknowledgement of her flaws was more for Lucy than it was for him. Mm-hmm. I don't know. We can talk about that later when we get to the church scene.
Yeah.
But definitely seemed to be more helpful for Lucy.
It was. But the fact that he did it for Lucy to help Lucy was enormous growth on his part.
Yes, that's too. True, too.
Yeah.
And then we get Charlotte's call, which I am also adding to my Trouble Blood connection list.
That is a big one, yeah.
All of Charlotte is a major Trouble Blood connection, especially with her suicide attempt in Trouble Blood and then actual suicide in The Running Grave, which is still something that I, for some reason, can't believe happened. But this is how it started in Trouble Blood, drunk phone calls, right? And it seems like the trajectory of Charlotte was the same in Trouble Blood, but this time Strike wasn't taking the responsibility.
This made me think of that quote about the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. There, Charlotte is doing the same thing over and over, but this time Strike is very consciously not doing that same thing. He's chosen to break that cycle. It's the same situation, but different actions, very different results.
I'm so proud of this 41-year-old fictional man.
I know, me too. So proud.
So proud.
And I guess it's interesting that he just hangs up on one horrible woman and he realizes that another horrible woman has also reached out to him by slipping her number in his pocket.
It's like all these crazy women are moths and he's the badly wired lamp. They won't stop flying at him.
He's the lamp after all.
He was the lamp the whole time.
But in this book, he gets an electrician. And he fixes it.
An electrician for the soul.
Okay. Put that up there with some of the dumbest
it's like
things.
The chicken soup books, but for manly men.
I was going to say that I was proud of him for ripping it up and then, you know, well, maybe not. But I am still proud because there is true change in him in this book, but it doesn't mean that he's perfect. Although, again, certain parts of this book, one big part in particular, he is pretty much perfect in that. Those rescue scenes, he's literally perfect.
He's literally perfect. Our episode for that set of chapters is probably going to be like 3 hours long.
Yeah,
I think everyone should probably prepare themselves now because it's going to be a doozy.
All right, let's do chapter 4. This is our last chapter.
Yes.
Strike and Robin interview Will's father, Sir Colin Enser.
And the epigraph, 9 in the third place means, when tempers flare up in the family, too great severity brings remorse. And that's from hexagram 37, the family or the clan. This one is pretty straightforward as we meet the Ensers because there's a lot of tempers flaring, not just with the brother James, but Sir Colin talks about losing his temper when he met with Will. I don't know if James regrets his temper, but I think it's clear Sir Colin does. And what's interesting about this whole family dynamic is that even though I didn't really like James, especially after the coffee incident, I can't fault his anger. I think Joe did a really good job of showing all the different reactions that people might actually have in this situation. And anger is really understandable to me.
Yeah, it is. One thing that comes across plainly in these books is just how well Joe understands people and human nature. And it comes across particularly well, I think, in group interview settings.
Yeah. Actually, this might be a good place to put this because we got an email recently from someone named SwanFan17. Great name.
Excellent name.
That said that the dynamic with the Ensers reminded them of the story of the prodigal son from the Bible. And SwanFan summed up that story for us here in case you aren't familiar. The youngest son left home, wasted away his fortune, suffered, and was made to care for pigs and returned home thinking that he did not deserve to be his father's son. And the eldest son resents his brother's welcome when the father rejoices in the younger son's return. So yeah, I liked that a lot. Thank you for sending that email in because it seems very fitting.
It's super fitting, yes. So this hexagram talks a lot about the family as a microcosm of society, where each member has their appropriate place and the appropriate relationships between members are clearly defined in a strict hierarchy. And when the family fulfills these roles, there's order. Failing to do so leads to disorder and breakdown both of the family and then the society. The hexagram says, when the family is in order, all the social relationships of mankind will be in order. But what's interesting, what's most interesting to me about this epigraph is the part of this line that Joe deliberately leaves out. Because this line continues after the bit in the epigraph, good fortune nonetheless, when woman and child dally and laugh, it leads in the end to humiliation. So the meaning of this line is actually that too great a severity is preferable to too much indulgence, because at least severity results in discipline, whereas weakness leads to disgrace. And this is the stance that James takes in this chapter. He's very much on the side of severity, but Sir Colin and the epigraph itself seem to take a different view, a wiser, more gentle perspective of understanding towards the family members, right? I think it points to a different understanding of the family in general in the worldview of these books, not as a place of strict roles and hierarchies, but as a sort of a strong foundational unit built on love and acceptance and care. And that's what brings order to society when the family is healthy in that way.
So the chapter opens up with Strike and Robin headed to meet Sir Colin at the Reform Club. Mm-hmm. And we don't have locations up yet, or maybe there will be a couple by the time this episode comes out, but stay tuned to Strike fans for location pages, because I know that they're being worked on and those are always great to see. What stood out to me about this location was that it's on Pall Mall, which I think is how you say mm-hmm. it, which is the street right in front of St. James's Palace and Lancaster House, which we saw in Lethal White. It's also right around the same area as Christie's, the Ritz, Franco's. Anyway, I recognize the street name from working on old location pages, and I like it because there's just a ton of book locations in this one area, even more than I just said.
Mm-hmm.
It's yeah. definitely probably a good place to hit up if you want to see a ton.
I like the mention of the Reform Club because it's a bit of a hint to Sir Colin's character as well, because historically it was a famous gentleman's club that was associated with progressive reformist members like radicals, Whigs, leftists. It was also one of the first clubs to admit women as members. And when you contrast that with Chisel's club that we saw in Lethal White, which was very stodgy and traditional and very yeah. male, and we've got two very different civil servants.
I like that because we see that he knows the Chisels. And yeah. it was the only thing about him that made me go, yeah. you know? But you're right. These are very different men, very different husbands and fathers.
Very much so.
There's this paragraph that gives us a formal introduction to Sir Colin Ensor. And from the start, I really liked him. I know that I can't really draw a parallel here to Troubled Blood based on who I like, but I would say that as far as likable clients go, it's Sir Colin, Anna, and Leonora.
Yeah.
Right.
That's about it.
Yeah, definitely.
I liked him too. And I was so afraid that it was a trap and that he turned out to be secretly evil. Honest to God, I was paranoid all book instead of just being able to enjoy him. This Aww. Is what Jo has done to me. This is what she's turned me into.
Mm.
Suspicious of everyone who's nice or good looking or both.
My favorite line about him was that he had a quiet reputation for intelligence and integrity. Mm-hmm. It immediately made me think of that bit towards the end where he wants to quietly give Pat money to help pay for Will's food and clothing.
Oh, yeah.
I think that was a really good example of that reputation coming through.
That was lovely.
And another thing I really liked about him was that he wasn't afraid of throwing away his good reputation to come out strongly against the UHC.
Yes. And this is where we get those accusations that he only cares about the trust fund. But we know that that's not true. And again, I don't blame him for caring about that money either when it's funding this evil organization, right?
Yeah. Like I just said, the only thing that made me slightly iffy about him is that he seems to be friendly with the Chisels, or at least Izzy.
I mean, I suppose he would have had contact with Chisel through both working government, maybe, because they mm-hmm. don't seem like likely friends.
No.
But he doesn't say they were friends, just that he knows the family. I know yeah. a lot of assholes, you know?
I'm just kind of curious how he came to ask Izzy.
Yeah.
You know, but a nice thing that Izzy said.
Yeah, it was really nice of her, and totally true. I guess that Sir Colin isn't the only one with a quiet reputation for intelligence and integrity.
Why does it sound suddenly sexy when you're talking about Strike?
I mean, do you even need to ask that?
I know, that was a stupid question. Sir Colin begins to tell the whole story and tells that story of how the other boys convinced him to set a chapel on fire. This might be a big stretch, I realize this, but a chapel being set on fire reminds me of Strike threatening to burn the church to the ground. And I don't know,
oh, shit.
Will is such a big part of that. And not because he fell for the peer pressure, but because he fought against it.
Yeah.
So it almost feels like a little foreshadowing that Will is going to help burn this church to the ground.
It is good foreshadowing. It also reminds me of that court case that Ilsa won in Ink Black Heart that she tells Robin about over champagne with the profoundly autistic.
I remember that chapter.
Yeah.
Weird.
Profoundly autistic teenage girl. That's so weird. What else was significant about that chapter?
Can't imagine.
Anyways, this profoundly autistic teenage girl who thought she'd found friends but was dragged into terrorism. I knew that bit felt like a foreshadowing hint. I don't know if I said it out loud, but in my head, I knew.
I wonder if there's anything like that in this book.
I feel like there's gotta be. We
besides all the pizza,
stay on the lookout. The pizza is a big clue. The pizza and the coffee, I'm standing by this, are big clues. I don't know what's going down with pizza in the next book, but it's something.
So there's a lot of information that we're given in this chapter about Will joining the church, and yeah. it lets us know what to expect when Robin goes in. The no contact, the underfeeding, the weight loss, the hard labor. Literally labor.
Oh God, yeah.
Mm. Oh yeah. Whenever I was reading this, the anxiety and the dread for what Robin was about to go through, like outside even of any potential for sexual abuse, was really starting to build for me here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Next we get this outburst from James. And I said earlier that I understand anger as a response, but it's hard rereading his criticisms now that we've read the book and know that Will was never given the messages and how mm-hmm. they controlled people with fear. It's not really as simple as he's making it seem.
No, it isn't. And you know, you identify with James in this chapter a bit, but later in the book,
yeah,
not quite so much. We'll get to that though.
Yeah, I know. What happens next when Sir Colin breaks down over his wife's death and her dying wish to get Will out? That was really sad and touching.
I just realized that it makes such a nice change to have a loving, competent, likable, living parental figure in these novels. When was the last time we had one of those at the front and center of the case?
I feel like Leonora is probably the closest that we've ever gotten.
I guess. Yeah. But that's it. Mm-hmm, every yeah. other parent in the case has been a total shit for most of the time, right?
Well, Lula's mother.
Yeah.
Okay, we said Leonora. I don't really think there's parents in
Career of Evil, no, but the
Chisel,
ugh.
And then you said living, because Margo was a nice parent.
Margo was lovely, but she was dead, and we got Roy fucking Phipps. Shit.
And then, yeah, even worse than Roy Phipps, Inigo.
Even worse somehow.
I know it's not case-related, but it's making me think of Strike pointing out the differences between Leda as a mother and Lucy as a mother.
Oh, yeah.
I don't really know where I'm going with this, but the idea about a loving, living parent just connected that for me.
Healing from bad parents to become a good parent yourself.
Yeah. And then obviously I like this next part where Sir Colin mm-hmm. talks about how bad Patterson Inc. was, because obviously that's hilarious. But I was worried when it talked about the cameras all around the perimeter and how no one ever leaves, because I was like, how are they going to keep in contact with Robin? How is she going to get out?
It's terrifying.
It is. Let's talk about Kevin being shot, though, because I think we have a good, I don't know if it's a clue, but when Sir Colin says that he changed his mind that the UHC was involved in the shooting because mm-hmm. they don't need guns, they've got expensive lawyers, I didn't believe this at all.
No.
I was convinced that the UHC was behind the shooting, even up until the car chase. I thought it was the UHC doing this, but mm-hmm. this first take ends up being 100% accurate, and it feels so obvious now to see these two different approaches.
I too was absolutely convinced the UHC was behind it as well, because like, it's a novel, of course they're behind it. I think that later on when we're immersed in the cult, we see them as so terrifying and powerful that it seems completely logical they just kill Kevin in the outside world, right? Yeah. And then eventually we see their actual outside world tactics, and it's the vandalizing Wikipedia pages, false non-credible accusations, law nonsense. Really, I should have realized earlier, but I was so scared of them because of what Robin went through, right?
Me too. Yeah. Oof. Okay, so right after this, we see another example of real UHC tactics when Sir Colin tells them that Kevin's sisters have now accused him of sexual abuse. Mm. And at first, I had no idea if I thought this was true or not, because I was thinking that they were probably just trying to discredit him. But also, if you're in a place where there's all this coerced and forced sex, you can see how that might happen.
Yeah, you read this and there's an element of, well, they're in a cult. It could totally be true. But the timing of this was always a bit suspicious, right? And then you've got to think of the cognitive dissonance of Emily and Becca accusing Kevin of a crime for behavior that the cult encourages and sees as normal and happy. How can it be both at the same time, right? It would be significant. But of course, cults are experts in overcoming cognitive dissonance. So yeah, you can hold two totally contradictory ideas at the same time. No problem. It's a cult.
Yeah.
Also, foreshadowing of the tactics they're going to use against Robin here later.
Ugh. Yeah.
Bastards. How dare they?
And I think we know that this wasn't true now from that argument between Emily and Becca, right?
Yeah.
That's where that was.
Yeah, that is where that was. And I'm glad that we can absolve Kevin of those accusations.
Me too, because I like him.
Yeah, I like him too.
And also notice how the UHC has no problem talking about familial relationships when it serves them. Kind of like how earlier Sir Colin mentions that they don't put the drowned prophet will bless all who worship her at the end of letters regarding money or to lawyers.
Yeah, suddenly they're not flesh objects.
Right.
Yeah.
There's this little line in here about how Sir Colin's lawyers thought Kevin's testimony on his own wouldn't be good enough because of his odd beliefs. And it says that Patterson couldn't find any other former members to confirm the story.
Patterson's so fucking useless.
I know.
Seriously.
Oh my God. Poor Kevin, because of his beliefs. I really wish that someone in his life could have done a quick Google search and demonstrated the allusions to Kevin, right? Like the Pepper's ghost, levitation. He needed the dentist so that he could understand how the church had tricked him. Yeah.
I love Dennis.
But I guess that him being in there his whole life, it'd probably be harder to debunk this stuff for him than to debunk it for Will.
But I knew right then and there that Shrike and Robin were absolutely about to find other members.
Oh, of course, because they're competent detectives.
We also get a tiny introduction to Alexander Graves, and we're told about his suicide, the first suicide of this book, right? I don't really have much on this other than it feels important to mention as Dai's real father and as one of the many suicides.
So many suicides in this book. And if we're looking at tiebacks to 4 and 1 here, to Lethal Light and Cuckoo's Calling, both of those featured a suicide that was actually a murder.
Yeah.
But now we've got so many real suicides.
And attempted ones. And then just more praise for Sir Colin from me here because of the goals that he has for what he'd like Shrike and Robin to actually accomplish. It's very practical. Find anyone who can confirm the allegations against Wace because then he might legally be able to do something to get Will out. It seems logical, practical. I doubt he ever thought that they'd actually be burning it all to the ground.
It's like he doesn't even know whose series of novels he's in.
He doesn't. Yeah.
Rookie mistake. He should have asked for the moon.
I know. Yep.
It.
You know what I just thought though? If they charge by the hour, does that mean that they have 4 months of nonstop billing going on since Robin was never off the clock?
Oh my God.
They must have, right? Yeah. I hope she got a nice bonus for that.
She better have. I feel like Sir Colin should have given her an enormous thank you gift after all this, above and beyond the bonus, because she got locked in a box. She was drowned. She was sexually assaulted. He needs to buy her a brand new thank you car or something. A luxury cruise, but not with Murphy, just with Strike. Because, you know, she really went above and beyond for his son.
She did. She really does deserve it.
She does deserve
it. I know she would probably say it's all part of the job, but she really deserves it.
I just wanted to go on a cruise with Strike. Is that such a bad thing?
I wanted to go anywhere with Strike.
Anywhere.
She used to go to Greece with Strike.
Still waiting on that.
All right. What are we doing in our next episode, Kenz?
In the next episode, we're doing chapters 5 through 10. And in these chapters, we see Strike and Wardle having a chat. Robin and Strike meet up with Prudence, and Robin attends her first UHC meeting.
Ooh, I'm excited to talk about Wardle because as hard as we've been on him, I actually liked him in this book.
He looks really great compared to Murphy. Comes out well in the comparison.
Well, especially when they have that meeting and he takes it very seriously.
That redeemed him for me.
Yeah, he scored some points with me big time in this book. Same. Yeah. And obviously the chapter with at Prudence's house is going to be amazing. Electric even.
I see what you did there.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.